Accession number 30078, reel 1.
Patrick Emerson, reel 1. If we could start with when and where you were born.
I was born in Burgess Hill, London, August 1918. My father was Anglo-Argentinian, in that my grandfather had gone out to Argentina in the middle of the 1800s. My father was a civil engineer. He worked with my great uncle, Sir William Emerson, who was the designer of the Victoria Memorial in Calcutta. And my mother was Irish. Her family had left Ireland in 1848, the potato famine, and they had a shop in the Notting Hill area. I don't know how or why they married, anyhow they did, and we were living in Burgess Hill. I was born there. Little memory, obviously, of it, except in 1922 there was a vast thunderstorm, and Ditchling Common was behind us, and half the hayricks got struck and were burning away. And I was scared, really, thinking the end of the world had come, not knowing really at that age what the end of the world was, anyhow. And then we moved to Brighton, stayed there for a year. My sister was born, and then we moved to a house at Hastings. It was a fairly big house because my father, like all estancieros in Argentina, were looked upon as millionaires, which he wasn't by any manner of means. But therefore, he felt he ought to live up to the standards, so we lived far beyond our means. And he died in that house when I was just 10. My mother tells me he died of heart and other troubles. I like to think he died of women and drink, because he did enjoy both very much. Result was, of course, we found he'd been living off capital in order to keep up that level of life. We moved to a small cottage in Devon, which was probably the most enjoyable period of my life, because my mother let me and my sister run wild. We were down in the sea doing everything. I did put up one record. I fell 120 feet down the cliff. Apparently my head hit the cliff on the way down, knocked me unconscious, so when I landed on the sand below I was completely floppy and landed. And the next thing I remember is the Coast Guards having me in a cave and me being violently sick. I can just remember a Coast Guard saying, "Oh, you had carrots for lunch." Then
which cliff was that, sorry?
It was between Thurlston and Kingston. There are a whole series of high cliffs going along there. They're sort of valleys, you know, the way where they go up, the cliffs are very high. My sister and I used to go climbing. My mother was very good. She left us entirely free to do what we liked. Meanwhile, of course, we were both going to boarding schools. I was going to a Roman Catholic one in Windsor, Beaumont, but I was only at the prep school, St. John's. My sister was going to a convent in Farnborough, very, very small, she was. I had no idea what I wanted to do, I mean, not having a father to direct me towards anything. And my mother's sister was a very famous matron in the QAs, the Army Nursing Service. She was feared by everybody. She was the real old type sister. When she came into ward, a frisson ran round the place and everybody froze and stood like it. And she said to my mother, "I think you better go into the army, do him good." And she brought a book home by Sir, I think it's William McMahon, with lots of fine paintings in it, all the old uniforms. Of course, this took me entirely with all the colour and that and that and the other. So it was all, I was always understanding that I would be going into the army anyhow from about the age of 12, after my father had died. He just told me, "You're going into the army, that's it."
Had you had any interest in civil engineering?
No, I knew nothing about it. I didn't even know what it was. But I mean, see, he never had time to tell me. When he died, being 10, I obviously wouldn't have been interested. So I hadn't a clue what civil engineering was. To me, it was just engineering. or the civil power, well, that wasn't at all sure. And then, so everything was geared at Beaumont towards me going to Sandhurst. I took the army exam, went up for the interviews, thought I'd failed, but got in about a third of the way from the bottom. You had in those days three terms at Sandhurst, which was a total of 18 months. You could join at the beginning of any term. Because of my age, you had to be a certain age, I forget just what it was, but I missed it by 3 days because of my birthday. So I didn't join until September 1936. I was in number four company, and I went through the 18 months and ended up as a senior lance, a senior corporal. That just means a corporal in the senior term group. But of interest, with my junior corporal as Lord Carrington, who then was the Honourable Carrington, but became Lord while there. Never, this is a side bit now, I never saw him again till the funeral of Lady Slim some years ago. And he was talking to people, and by now, of course, he was a well-known politician who'd resigned over principles and so on. And he was talking to three people. I thought, well, I must have a word with him. So I stood at the side only, and he could sense me standing here, kept looking around at me. And so these three went away, and he tried the usual politician on me. Glad to see you. Yes, had a long time there. I said, you're not really, you know, you haven't seen me since Sandhurst for number four company, have you? And he said, good God, you're still alive. And we had quite a good natter. It was so funny getting the politician's glad hand, first of all, and then him realizing it was an entirely different thing. Anyhow, went through Sandhurst, and switched off the name.
What did the course at Sandhurst involve? Could you describe a bit more about that?
Looking back, thank you.
You want a
cake
as well?
No, thanks.
Biscuit?
Okay. Mm. It meant, I'm sure Matteo was recording.
Plenty of tea there.
It meant, well, looking back on it now, it didn't really do much more than what you might say recruit training. It taught you to drill, to shoot, to do all the things that a soldier should know. But added on to it were lessons called tactics and strategy, but quite honestly, I don't know whether I really learnt much about tactics or strategy. This all came much later on in army service. And it taught you military discipline, how to behave in the army and how it was expected of you to behave as well, which was quite important in those days. This is all pre-war approach. And I don't know, it did one a lot of good physically, because you had to go through not only the drill, which was very heavy, but also physical training, riding if you didn't know how to. That was quite a job to learn it. And of course, in sports, you had to take part. You could choose what sport you liked. Well, I rowed at school, so I chose rowing. But you had to take part in the sport. You couldn't just go off and do nothing. So you were doing something all day long. You had a room to yourself, which for some of us was new, because at school we'd had dormitories of three or four people as you got to senior level. And you learned how to polish boots and one or two things, but you also had servants, ex-soldiers, forget what they were called, it was some odd nickname they had for all of them, and they would do a lot of the polishing and that, and make the beds and do things in your room. But on the whole, you learn, it did do you a lot of good. It made you from a rather brash schoolboy, because you were at the top level at school, into somebody who could belong to a group, fit in, knew what to do, and knew you had to take responsibility. I can't really sum it up, I think, more than that. Anyhow, in your second term, you were asked to choose where you wanted to go, your regiment, or the Indian Army. I obviously chose Indian Army because I'm still remembering the colours in the books. It used to be said it was very difficult to get into the Indian Army. Well, that was true in the older days because the pay was better. It was a kind of overseas pay, and life was better in that you had bearers and servants and things like that. But by the time in the 30s, when I was there, it wasn't that, well, if I got in, it wasn't that hard. And I got in quite easily. As a side story, if I may, we were all lined up alphabetically, and next to me was Erskine Tulloch, who's now a retired brigadier, CBE. We still keep in contact. Now, he came from a very old Indian Army family. They had been in India for 200, 300 years. And when we came to choose the regiments, I said to him, Pat, which regiment are you going into? He said, oh, I'm going to a British regiment. And I said, why? You're Indian Army family. He said, my father has told me the way things are going, I won't be able to finish my military career out there. Normally, military career you looked upon, say, 25 to 30 years. He said, I won't be able to finish that. Things are moving on the political side in the world. Now, this was quite prescient of him because this was before the war when people were talking, oh, yes, the empire had gone forever sort of thing. So he made a wise, I wish I'd had somebody to guide me, but I didn't, so I put down Indian Army. I don't regret being in the Indian Army, but I regret I wasn't able to have a full career.
How much at that stage did you know about India? How much did you know about India at that stage?
Absolutely nothing. Not a thing, just little bits I'd read. And I obviously knew some of the history of it. I had that from school with, you know, our wonderful wars in the Punjab and the Marathas and all this, that and the other, which I learnt about in a different manner when I got to India and began to meet people and talk to them. But I had no other idea than that of India at all. And no idea how the army lived or anything in that way. They did teach a few people in Urdu classes in Sandhurst. And this is one of my criticisms of Sandhurst at that time, that once they knew you wanted to go to the Indian Army and you'd been accepted, which would be in your second term, so you still had part of the second term and all the third term left, we should have gone on to Urdu-speaking classes immediately, and also a kind of history of India, the military side of it, but they didn't. So when you arrived out there, you neither spoke the language, nor did you really know an awful lot about the country and so on. I feel that was one sad thing they could have taught us. So we were commissioned. I was sure I'd failed. I got my mother to give me permission to sleep downstairs that night near the front door, waiting for the paper, because they didn't get the things posted to you. It was all just published in the Times and the Telegraph. And I opened up the Telegraph, and being me, I started reading from the bottom of the list. And I got up to just about halfway, and I hadn't seen my name, and I pretty well burst into tears and said, oh, I've failed. My mother came down for breakfast. I said, I've failed. Like that. Later in the day, she read through the list, and here she said, but your name's here. I said, can't be. She said, it is. You're just above halfway. That was really surprised me, because I never thought that would happen. Anyhow, I got it. We then had 2 months, 2.5 months leave, in which I went on a tour of Europe with an ex-schoolmaster of mine from Beaumont, and fill up, will you, as you wanted, an ex-schoolmaster of mine from Beaumont and another Beaumont boy whom I've been friendly with, and we drove around France, Italy. When we got to Switzerland, where my uncle lived with his family, he had a wire from my mother saying, tell Patrick to come back at once. They're sailing on September the 3rd or 4th or something like that. So, because I came back by train, it was by this time my mother had remarried. I had a stepfather, I was not particularly fond of, but then I can't criticize him because he looked after us. That had happened much earlier on when I was about 14. He then spent about 2 hectic days in London driving me around, But in those days, all you had to do was to go to the Army and Navy stores and say, I've just been commissioned, I'm going to India. And they said, yes, sir, certainly, we know just what you want. And they did all of it, from the trunk, all the clothing, everything you needed. And so you only bought one or two odd things elsewhere. And I joined the troop ship, the Dilwara, at Southampton. And I always remember right opposite it, berthed opposite, was the Queen Mary. And it looked so vast compared to the little ship we were getting into. I thought, God, we'll never get there with a ship that size. My aunt came down. She was then second matron at Netley, which was the big hospital in that area. She came to see me off, but apart from, well, goodbye, Patrick, hope all goes well, she spent the rest of her time with all the senior officers who were there, because she knew them all and they knew her. Mine was just, goodbye, Patrick, hope all goes well, which I was rather grateful for, because I would have felt silly with a lady with a red cape and medals, because she had been in the First World War. She was covered in gongs. But a very, very fine member of the QAs, and she is still talked about, even these numerous years later. We sailed, we went straight through to Malta. We didn't stop at Gibraltar. At Malta we were allowed ashore for about 2 days. Did the usual thing, had a look at the fort and everything else. One thing only is always stuck in my mind from Malta. I happened to be up on the fort with two or three others at sunset, and to hear all the bands, in those days the big battleships existed, to hear the band of each battleship playing the evening hymn and the flag slowly coming down and the sun actually setting, it's a scene I've never forgotten. It just stuck in my mind all the way through. We're off from Malta, and then suddenly we were told we're not going to Portside, we're going to Haifa, because at that time there was the trouble in Israel, well, Palestine as it was then. Some British, I think, had been shot and so on. We got to Haifa, and the Dorsets, they have a badge, a rope that's in a double knot. I think Dorsets. They were on board. They were unloaded. They had to take over duties in Palestine. And we were told, well, go wandering. Carry your revolver. Gave us no rounds. We had empty revolvers hanging on us. Carry your revolver. Don't bloody well get shot. Off we went. So had a good look around Haifa and Mount Carmel and all that round there. Then we set sail with just us, about 43, 44 officers for the Indian Army on board, the only ones. Got down to Portside, and they said, well, now we're not quite sure what's going to happen now. It's no good a troop ship going on with just you people on board, so the other arrangements will be made. Meanwhile, we had about 5 days there, and we were pretty well given the run of the town. So obviously we were down to all the famous Portside brothels, and we saw the famous donkey doing a woman and things like that. We made sure we saw every bloody thing we could. And we all bought our first civilian topies at the famous shop Simon Arts, which was known all over the Far East. And it was the last place people bought stuff coming home and the first place people bought stuff going out east. And then they said, right, tomorrow, have everything packed up and ready, you're going the rest of the way on P&O Strathallan, first class, which of course, what's the word I want to, made us as happy as anything. We boarded, and it was full of not only passengers who were going out to business, and of course it goes on to Australia as well, business and things like that, but also part of the fishing fleet. And if you know, the fishing fleet were the eligible girls who were sent out every year by their parents to India in the cooler weather in the hope that they would get a husband. And most did. Some came back. In fact, one of my mother's sisters, Aunt Terry, she had been on the fishing fleet but didn't get anything. She was bloody ugly. And but she lived a spinster's life after that, was very good in looking after me and my sister when my mother was either ill or doing something else. She lived up in London, in what was the Irish enclave of Ladbroke Grove, all that area. Anyhow,
were they chaperoned aboard?
Pardon?
Were they chaperoned?
Yes, I think most of them were when they went there. They nearly all were going out to somebody. The parent at home had made arrangements with other people, but I don't think they were chaperoned to that tightness of effect, you know, that one imagines, sort of being followed all round. But I think they were introduced to as many officers as possible, obviously. I never was at a station where we had them, so I honestly don't know how they were handled. Sounds a bad way of putting it, how they were handled, but you know what the organisation was for them. We went through two typhoons, one after the other, which was I was quite a good sailor from living in Devon, but it was my first experience of real typhoons, and I honestly thought the ship was going to disappear. It was a big liner, when you saw the bow literally go underwater and come up again, I said my last prayers to our fathers and said, well, here I go. But we got through it, and we came to Bombay. First thing...
Before you go on to that, sorry, how did you spend your time throughout the voyage aboard ship?
Oh, well, on the troop ship, we were all given responsibility of a certain number of soldiers. So you went down in the morning to see they were up, dressed, and so on. It was all very slow and that. Then we go up for breakfast and have a long breakfast. Then there'd probably be some arms drill, and you supervise that. Then PT for everybody. Then a long break for lunch, a sleep after lunch. And then in the evening, probably either lectures or arms training, you know, static arms training and that type of thing. Probably followed by a concert put on by the troops, you know, just anybody who could do anything. And then they went down for their meals, and we had dinner and, you know, just hung around the anteroom. Must remember our pay was £1 a day as a second lieutenant, which I know now is absolutely absurd. In those days it got you through, but you couldn't afford very much. I mean, you couldn't afford to buy whiskies and things. Our drink was lemonade and this sort of stuff. And the boat being full of a whole regiment of senior officers and then other senior officers going out, you weren't too sure of your position. You know, you thought, yes sir, no sir, doing this, that and the other. But it was an enjoyable journey. You each, if there were enough of you, each did a duty like orderly officer and so on. And here again I have one abiding memory of being orderly officer all night one night and standing on the deck in the morning with the orderly sergeant, and the sea was just like glass and the sun came up and there was this bar of gold all the way from the horizon to the boat. Just a complete piece of gold. I've seen like it since. It was really wonderful. Everything was so quiet and peaceful, just the engine going thum, 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 thum in the background. It's funny how these little scenes stick with you. So we pulled into Bombay. The first thing we noticed was the heat, because Bombay, Calcutta, Madras, or if you like their modern names, they've been near the sea. They are a wet heat. It really, you perspire. I don't perspire, I sweat. It just pours off. You notice that, but also you notice the vast number of people. Key was alive with people all over the place. And, of course, in forms of dress you'd never imagined before, you know, dhotis and pyjamas and things wound round their heads. I remember leaning on the rail and just looking in amazement at all that was going on. Then an embarkation officer came on board and we were all summoned and we were told that, right, you'll be going here, you'll be going there, so on. Indian Army officers had to do a year's attachment to a British regiment first. The idea was quite sensible. It was a time for you to learn the language and to learn, if I may put it, to be an officer. As you remember I said at Sandhurst you really learnt to be a good recruit and a good soldier. Now you had to learn how to be an officer to look after soldiers. And he said where we were going. I was going to a place called Nasirabad in Rajputana with three other officers. We were going to be attached to the 1st Battalion, the Lincolnshire Regiment. And then he said, right, now we'll have bearers for you. And we thought, well, what do we do? Do we go and choose bearers or what? He said, no, it's all arranged. And the adjutant of each battalion knew who was coming and sent down men to be bearers. I was very lucky. I had a Cuttack Pathan of about 40 called Hayat Khan, who'd been a bearer for many years, because the first thing they used to do was to show you all their certificates from previous Saabs. And he just knew everything. You didn't have to do a thing. So that evening, a military transport took us to Bombay Central, and Hayat really took over. He found out which carriage had been reserved for us, got the baggage in, did everything. The other three bearers with him, of the other three officers, and got us all the way on board. We went up to Ratlam, where we changed from normal gauge to narrow gauge, and just sat in the carriage, hot as hell. They cooled the carriages in those days by putting a large block of ice in the center on the floor, which quickly melted. You were cool for a little while, then you were hot again. I had bought a small automatic pistol, and I think the feeling we all had of we're now in the country, we're the lords of the country, not in a snobbish way, but you felt a bit senior because everybody was saying, Salaam Saab, how are you Saab? And I remember firing this out of the window at nothing, which is a thing I would never have dared to do in England, but there, we're in charge and it's India, bang, 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 and so on. A lot of it, I know this sounds childish, much of it. Anyhow, we got to Nasirabad, which is a small station, and there was another fellow who'd been at Santos with us already standing, Hugh Donovan. And he was also attached to Lincoln's, but he'd come out, 30 of them had come out by crossing France by train and then being put on a liner, and they came from Marseille direct to Bombay. We never know why they were done that way, whether the troop ship, because it was taking a battalion, had no more room or what. So he'd got to Nasirabad about a week before us. So the adjutant said to him, right, well, these other four are coming, now you go down and, you know, help them in. So he met us, took us to our various bungalows, which was somewhat surprising because mine was an old one built about 1840, 1850. So they were sort of vast, spacious rooms, high to let the heat go up and so on. And he told us, change into our mess kit. Now, we'd never worn Indian mess kit before, and so for the first few nights, we wore our blue patrols from Sandhurst, but with the second lieutenant's pipon, which we never had at Sandhurst. You know, you had just plain epaulette. And we went up, walked into the mess, and of course, we were introduced and looked upon, sort of, you know, what do these people come in? The Lincolns were good to us, but not outstanding. But some regiments treated their attached officers not too nicely. They made them feel that you're only attached and, you know, keep quiet and that. Lincolns were pretty fair with us. The only trouble was little things got you down, like if you're eating in the mess, which you were meant to do, at evening you would go there at about 7:30 after you'd had a bath, and you had to wait in the anteroom till the senior major decided it was time to go in and eat, and he probably was a whiskey lover, and he went on drinking and drinking and drinking. You might not get your meal till 10 o'clock, by which time you were ravenous. But you had to wait till he said, right, we'll go in and eat. With the pay of £1, you couldn't really afford much more than lemonade. That was probably the main drink. And we did tend to congregate towards one end of the mess table, but I think that was possibly because we knew each other. We didn't know the Lincoln people, and they knew themselves. But there wasn't any segregation at all, but it just so happened that we did. Right. We were then next day up to the colonel, met the colonel, to the adjutant, who was a fairly brusque young captain, or middle-aged captain, and he allocated us to two companies, and Donovan and myself were sent to B Company to a Major Gates, L.C. Gates, and in those days, the company commanders, many of them still had First World War medals. They were still serving because they'd been second lieutenants in the First War. Well, this was only, 1828, 30, it was only 20 years later, so it was within their span of service.